Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. On today's show, I'll be presenting another in my Health Challenges series. My guest is Zila Eisenstein. Eisenstein is a political theorist, longtime activist, and author. She taught at Ithaca College for 35 years and is now a distinguished scholar and professor emeritus. She is author of many books, including Against Empire, Feminisms, Racism in the West, and Man-Made Breast Cancers. In 1988, she was diagnosed with breast cancer, and in 2008, yet another ovarian-like tumor was found, and we'll talk about her long personal journey with cancer, a disease that not only affected her, but many members of her family. And welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
Now, you were diagnosed with breast cancer in 1988 at the age of 40, but you knew this terrible disease way before that. Your mother had it, your aunt, two of your sisters. Talk to us a little bit about this history.
Well, the history, you know, you never know you're in history while it's happening. I received a phone call my first year of college from my father to tell me that my mother had breast cancer. And in those days, breast cancer was equated with death, and mm-hmm. I did think she would die, and she did not. She lived to be 92.
Wow.
So the story of my two sisters, Sarah and Gia, they both were diagnosed with breast cancer when they were in their mid-20s. And my beloved sister Sarah died just before she turned 30. And my sister Gia then contracted ovarian cancer, late diagnosis, as it usually is, had a brutal struggle and fight. But anyway, so that's to say that my youth, when I was in my 20s, was defined very much by breast cancer. Yeah. Now I'm in my 60s, and life is still very much defined by so many friends and friends' daughters who are dealing with the issue of breast cancer or the disease.
It's an endless cycle. So tell us, well, when you were first diagnosed, you say you had no symptoms, nothing showed up on a mammogram, but you did find a lump. So tell us about this trajectory into your diagnosis, which is so shocking.
Well, I mean, the thing about cancer, any form of cancer truly, is most of the time you don't feel sick, you know, unless it's a very advanced stage. So I had no symptoms, and I was doing a breast exam, but I can honestly say, even with the life of Gia and Sarah, I was not very focused on it. I mean, I refused to let that create a kind of fear in me. But I did find a small lump and actually went to see a well-known gynecologist at the time, beloved Catherine Husa, who said, yes, you know, that it needed to be checked immediately. And because she knew the history of my sisters, she just saw that it was done momentarily. And then from there, things went pretty quickly with incredible attention and care from the medical community in Ithaca. I did not go elsewhere.
Oh, that is so good to know. And you know, the heartbreaking thing is, you know, your sisters died, and you had a three-year-old daughter at this moment.
I did, and I thought I was going to die.
Yes.
But I did think that actually, with the help of my doctors who just said, Zila, this is stage one. We are catching it very early, but we are going to throw everything at you, including, for people listening, if you've been on it, the hated drug called adriamycin. Mm. So even though it was early stage, et cetera, I went through a bit of hell with a mastectomy then, a prophylactic mastectomy for the other breast shortly thereafter, and a hellish regime of chemotherapy on adriamycin.
Wow.
So you fought like hell, right?
I mean,
I did fight like hell.
So some people say, I don't want those drugs. They're worse than the disease. You fought like hell at that time.
Well, I did. I had a three-year-old daughter, and I really wanted to be alive for her.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, there were times where I would just say, just let me see her graduate sixth grade at BJM. Let me see her graduate, you know, high school. And then it was college, and then it was medical school. And so, like, if I tomorrow am told my CA-125 is up and, you know, I'm done, I will never do chemotherapy again.
Yeah.
I feel like I've had my fair share, though, of our healthcare system. And if we get to that in this, I would like to talk about not being greedy about.
Yeah, well, no, I am going to bring that up. You know, something you said in Man-Made Breast Cancer struck me. It says that cancer makes women fear their bodies. Talk to me about that. That makes perfect sense to me. But I've had a lot of people who've survived cancer say, I am not going to let it make me fearful of my own self. To tell me what your story is about that.
Well, I don't know if it made... Did I say in the book
that
it made me fearful of my body?
It makes women fear their bodies.
Well, of course, women, we are all, constructed in a culture. So the culture we live in is to fear disease and definitely to fear cancer, although I think people fear cancer less today than they did 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And AIDS has a lot to do with that, but then AIDS also has gotten redefined. But I actually feel pretty strongly that that kind of fear is cultural, but really unhelpful. And I think that although we're talking about cancer and particularly breast cancer and for me, ovarian-like cancer, mm-hmm. disease is a part of life.
It is.
You know, and so many people I know struggle with daily illnesses, some of them with, great trepidation, others who sometimes have a free day of pain. But I think that we come to isolate and kind of other disease, the way we other people, as opposed to really embracing it as part of who we are.
Part of being alive.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And part of being alive is accepting that we die. My struggles with cancer have made me very conscious of wanting to not fear death. And I think it's made me a brave person.
Yeah, I think anybody who knows you would agree with you on that. What are your thoughts about this cancer gene, the BRCA gene, that they seem to try to map in families? Do you think it's true? Because in your breast cancer's book, you talk about environmental damage, which I think is a major part of it.
Right. Well, I felt as though I have, at the time that I wrote this book, they didn't have the BRCA 1 and 2 mutation testing, mm-hmm. Although everyone was pretty sure that it must exist in my family, given the huge
I would think so,
presence
yeah.
of it. But what my argument really was that if anyone could argue that breast cancer is more an environmental disease than a mutative disease, I have the right to do that. And it's uh-huh. because I come from a family now where it is absolutely clear that we all have had, all of us who have suffered breast cancer have had the mutation. But as I also say in the book, people who live in families who have shared experience of cancer as well, as Sandra Steingraber says in her book, mm-hmm. And I'm adopted. So, I mean, what was really the family existence there was really the environmental conditions of what the water, the air, whatever.
Absolutely.
So I fight in the book and in all my writing against dualisms. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to say that it's either or. And I do, but I do think that the BRCA mutation that is most prevalent in Ashkenazi Jews is that it still needs to be triggered because there are 30% of women, anywhere between 20 and 30% who have the mutation may not get breast cancer. So obviously there is something more than the mutation that defines it.
Has cancer shown up in the male sides of your family at all? Or is it always just the women?
Well, the only male side would be my father, and he did not have.
And neither did any of his relatives?
No,
that's really interesting.
None of the men.
Wow. Yeah. Well, tell us about 2008. You were at a conference in Paris, blood in your urine. This is the second diagnosis. I cannot believe that you've had to go through this twice.
Well, this is me. I mean, of course, I know all of the symptoms, etc. And I thought, geez, I must have really run way too hard. I'm a runner. I went for a run in between dinner and the next talk. And so I didn't mention it to anyone, and I just thought it'll pass. And
yeah, but you thought running would cause blood in your urine?
Well, I thought maybe I had, you know, kind of ruptured something. Uh-huh. You know, I really did think that maybe I had done something it wasn't a huge amount of blood, but it was definitely blood in my urine. And then it subsided for a couple of days at the conference. Then on the plane, I had it again. Came home, didn't mention it, and thought, okay, if in the next week this does not go away, I will have it checked out. And that's kind of also my rule about having had cancer, that I don't call a doctor until 5 weeks.
So you don't let yourself panic.
No. Mm. And because, you know, it is amazing, particularly I sometimes early on I'd put it in my book and just the calendar to make sure. But it's just amazing. You know, you could really have a pain like in your neck and it'll go away. I don't know why it was there, but it just goes away.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
No, I have this 5-week rule, and so I pretty much paid attention to that. But then, actually, we were up in the Vietnamese restaurant in College Town, you know, right on Dryden.
Yeah, yeah, I can't remember the name of it.
I was with a bunch of people and Richard having dinner, and I went to the bathroom, and the toilet was just filled with blood. And I thought, okay, something's really wrong.
And so you went to got tested again.
The next day, I mean, this is the amazing part of Ithaca. You know, Sammy Husseini saw me, and he said, okay, I think this is just there's definitely a tumor, but I think I can get rid of it, you know, quick enough. But that wasn't the case. It was very complicated. It was already it had already infiltrated the bladder.
And you said it's really rare and usually causes death. So what was it?
Well, they first, actually, when I went, they wanted me, as I did. I mean, Charles Garbo, also my oncologist for local people here, I have been with him for over 20 years. They knew immediately that I needed to have some of the specialists look at the tumor at Sloan Kettering, and I went. And I there did see two very well-known specialists, one a bladder specialist named Bernie Bochner, and the other is an ovarian specialist, or I should say gynecological specialist, and he does, his name is Dennis Chi. And he is well-known for debulking, which goes with ovarian cancer. The ovarian normally is not really tumors. It's more the sheets of cancer.
Oh.
So you can't really get it off of the organs, et cetera, but you try to debulk as much as you can from the body. So these were my two specialists for the surgery, and they found the tumor and removed it. And had to resect the bladder because it had grown into the bladder.
Oh, that's amazing.
But what I haven't said, and I don't really know if the listeners are all that interested, I always hesitate to talk about this because it's all about yourself, you know. And
but that's what we're talking about, though.
I know.
Yourself became this.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, so the point here was that the tumor was so unexpected in some sense because I had a prophylactic hysterectomy because my sister Gia had died of ovarian. So it was really at the behest of my doctors here the moment Gia was diagnosed with the ovarian cancer. They had me up in Syracuse with a specialist doing a prophylactic hysterectomy.
Wow.
So that probably saved my life.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Zila Eisenstein. I'm doing one of my Health Challenges series, and we're talking about her two bouts of cancer through her life here. And we're talking about her ovarian cancer that was diagnosed about 20 years after she had breast cancer. So was this second cancer in any way related to the first one, or was it totally separate?
It was totally separate, but it's related to the BRCA gene, they're thinking, the BRCA mutation, which puts you at great risk for both breast cancer and ovarian. But mine was not ovarian. If it was ovarian, I would be dead.
Yeah.
What this was was a peritoneal tumor that would happen in 0.05% of people who had the kind of chemotherapies previously and the amount of prophylactic surgery that I had. So they called it ovarian-like because it did not present as ovarian. Okay? The pathology was ovarian, but the presentation was not, the tumor, et cetera. At Sloan Kettering, and I will say this just as a plug for local medicine sometimes, at Sloan Kettering, they said that I had the rare form called urethral cancer, and they were absolutely sure of it. The pathologist here at our hospital said, no, the pathology is ovarian-like. It is not urethral. Oh. And in the end, when the tumor board met, and my tumor is numbered at Sloan Kettering as an unknown, I mean, one of the conundrums of all time. Okay.
Wow. It's like being have a star named
right,
after
exactly.
you.
Right, exactly. I have a tumor. And but he really was very responsible for pushing the tumor board there to, in the end, make this new category called ovarian-like.
Wow. So this second bout of cancer, did you hesitate at all in regard to treatments? I know you say you wouldn't do it now, but did you hesitate at all back then?
I did. When I was in with Dennis Chi, Dr. Chi, and he was speaking both to me and Richard, you know, my partner, and Sarah, my daughter, who at that time was a medical student. And he was saying what they were expecting and what they would do. I do remember saying to him, if I cannot have a really good life, I don't, just leave me alone,
you know. Yeah.
So they were completely surprised at what they found. It did seem somewhat handleable. They were ready, really, to do debulking and tell me.
Yeah. So you thought you'd have a good prognosis and let's do this. You'd still have a high quality of life, right?
Well,
as far as you knew.
I didn't know then. The big key thing was I did say, actually, to Sami Husseini, so should I just not do this surgery?
Mm.
And he said, no, absolutely you should do it because I think you have a good chance, you know. But when it was done, the doctors first said, no chemotherapy. We have no protocol for this. I mean, they have to have a protocol of the chemo, and this was so they had none. But then the tumor board, and I'm sure this has to do with the litigiousness of our society, said, you need to do chemotherapy, and you'll do the for ovarian. That's the closest we have. So I said to Sarah and Richard that I thought it was just a shot in the dark, and I wasn't going to do it.
Oh, well, thank God you did, Zila.
And then Charles Garbo said, Zila, your CA-125 is at 70. He said, that's just a little too high for my comfort. I want you to do the chemo. And I said, no. And so then Sarah said to me, Mom, if you die, I will always wonder if the chemotherapy could have kept you alive. So I will help you do this, but will you do this? And I said, okay, that would be awful for you to wonder that. So I will do it, but you can never ask me again.
Ah. Wow, what a story that is.
And she did say, okay. Now she is a doctor. And
you're still alive.
And I'm alive, but she would never ask me again.
Yeah. No, I understand that. God, what a perfect story in some ways. Now, let's talk about the fact that you have been in the medical landscape as an observer and a patient. How do you think it's changed since the 60s? And let's talk a little bit about the healthcare debate right now and what we're going to do about people having access.
Well, one of the things that, I mean, first of all, to even be talking about this on the day that, you know, the Republicans are just a mess and gutting and hateful about the need for health care in our country.
Mm-hmm.
It almost seems trite to be talking about breast cancer in the sense of just how at risk every body's body is at this moment.
Exactly.
And the poorer you are, the more oppressed you are in this country, of course, the more at risk you are as well. So But the one thing that I do want to say about the book as well, I mean, the initial discussion of breast cancer that makes me very sad, really, is that the way that racism and white privilege define every corner of people's lives in the United States. And my book really did really try to argue that breast cancer was a very particular, all of the narrative about it is a very particular kind. It's estrogen driven, et cetera. And mine is not estrogen driven. Many women who Ashkenazi Jews are not. But that's also true for black women. A lot of black women do not have estrogen driven. So, I mean, the dominant discourse was really about the people who are studied, where the research is being done. At the time I did the research for the book, you know, which is already, what, 2000, the book came out in 2001, yeah, 2001 yeah. So it was late 90s and then early 2000, there was a lot of focus on black women's health and black women's, the issue of breast cancer as having maybe some similarities with Ashkenazi Jews or having some similarities at least with mutations at the, because fewer black women get breast cancer, but more of them die from it as a result of dealing with it. And I went to really a lot of conferences that were completely about black women's breast cancer. And I spoke with people like Gina Lithcott, who was the director, dean, I think, of the Columbia School of Public Health, the Mailman School of Public Health. And she herself, a survivor of breast cancer, but also very committed to the public health issue of what about minority women and cancer and breast cancer in particular. And nothing's happened.
Yeah, I believe it.
And when I was just looking at the book to just prep a little for today, it just made me really sad.
Yeah, you know? I know. I mean, I hear reports all the time that they're still not studying women, let alone black women. You know, I mean, white women, black women, they're still mainly studying men in regard to disease. It's heartbreaking. Now, you also said that you'd never want disease to wholly define you. How do you get away from that after having lived through this, through your family, through your own life? How do you get away with it not defining you?
Well, you know, I still remember the first letter I got from the, what was the name of our hospital originally? I can't remember our local hospital. And they said, "Dear cancer patient," and I said, "Dude, never call me that again. I have a name." You know, it's like, you know, how people get treated in prison. I mean, you get a number. I mean, this idea that you lose an identity. But my feeling was that the struggle and the way that you try to make a life with this added difficulty and the trajectory of it starts to define new aspects of yourself. But I always have been committed to so many other parts of myself. I mean, being healthy is one part. Yeah. I mean, I have trouble with people who, you know, who have these rigid diets and, I mean, who, you know, ones that aren't kind of absolutely necessary, thinking that you can create health for yourself. And then that becomes a huge commitment of all time and effort.
And gets rid of everything else. Yeah. Talk to me about what we were talking about before, that the cancer has taught you to do things before you think you're ready. I find that really fascinating. What a great lesson.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't want to sound Pollyannish. If you gave me a choice, would you have liked to have lived your life without cancer? Would you like your sisters to be alive? Absolutely. Mm. So I don't want this to seem like it's a justification for what has been difficult. But I did, when the doctors on the second bout with the tumor, the bladder tumor, when they said to me that my chances were really not good, I decided that the one thing I had to do was prepare myself to die in a way that I respected so that I could help my beloved friends and my daughter and my partner let go of me and hold on to themselves. So that just, it was really a very painful process. I never want to ever be frightened of dying again. Mm. So I sometimes mentally make myself try to think about, you know, Zila, tomorrow you could just get a number on your CA-125 and, you know, you're on your way to the end. And that has to be okay. So to be honest, I did not expect to live as long as I have. Mm. So the first couple of years, it seemed easy to stay brave. Now that I've been alive for it's about 8 years, I get worried that maybe I think I'm okay about dying and that I'm not. But I think I am, in the sense that I really do think that death is, I want to be creative in how I die so that it is part of how I have lived. And I think that we all would be so much more humane if we weren't frightened of death. I think fear of death makes people do terrible things.
Oh, it does. It makes them panic. It makes them full of anxiety, and they can't think. Yeah, and I've seen it. And the you know, even people with disease who have to face the fact that they may die, what are other people thinking? They're not going to because they never got sick. And it's amazing. My father died at 98 last year, and he was so afraid of dying until the last few days. Then he said, "I'm ready. Bring on the coroner. I'm ready." But it took him that long. He was afraid of death up until then, till he was about 97. So
sometimes I'm more afraid of life, to be quite honest.
I can understand that,
you know,
too.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, so it is. But also, I mean, just the whole, all of the discourses in our country, it's all about fearing death. What's all this anti-terrorism and anti-this and anti-that and security? What is security about?
Yeah.
So the idea, I mean, of course, we want to create peace, yes. But we're our anti-terror stuff creates war everywhere.
I know.
So,
I know.
But for me, the theme of wondering and absorbing the issues around death are very, very political. They're not just individual and private at all.
Zila, we're almost out of time. Can you give contact information, a website, in case people want to get in touch with you?
Sure.
Find out about your books.
My website, and I'd love you to go to it because you'll see tons of stuff that has nothing to do with breast cancer and has everything to do with feminisms across the globe. And that would be http://zilaeisenstein.wordpress.com. And there's a slew of stuff there.
Yeah. Go check out Zila's stuff. She's a fascinating woman. Fascinating theorist, I must say. My guest has been Zila Eisenstein. We've been talking about health challenges and her journey with cancer. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me think about this again.
Thank you, Zila. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outoboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.